Nishchema. This particular talk is inspired by certain videos which have been going around on Sri Aurobindo, Hinduism, Sanatana Dharma, Christianity, God knows what not. So it is natural for human mind to compare, contrast, and if you really look at anything, you will see some common elements are there, some differences are there. But you have to see what is unique about the yoga itself. So otherwise, for example, of course we'll make a separate talk on it. There is a new trending to compare Sri Aurobindo and Swami Vivekananda. Some people also say that, well, derived from Swami Vivekananda. So first of all, we should know that there has never been any meeting between Sri Aurobindo and Swami Vivekananda. The only contact has been for 15 days in the Alipur jail, where Sri Aurobindo says he spoke to me on a very specific topic, and he uses the word regarding the intuitive mind and from there which way the supermind is. Which is intuitive mind, seers and sages, you can begin to have a glimpse of the supermind. So it's understandable, absolutely. It has nothing to do with achieving supermind and teaching him how to, you know, go ahead. Sri Aurobindo never regarded Swami Vivekananda or Sri Ramakrishna as his guru in any way, either outwardly or inwardly. He never received any initiation from them. There was no question of Swami Vivekananda, because 1904, in fact, Sri Aurobindo said jokingly, that time I had no idea about yoga in this sense. I mean, of course, yoga in the deeper sense is a continuation. So this is the first thing one needs to, if at all any human personalities had a role in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, apart from reading in general is a different thing. So these human personalities were first Yogi Vishnu Bhaskar Lele, rather obscure name, except for those who have turned to Sri Aurobindo may not know. And he was on the path of bhakti, and he taught him how to concentrate in the heart on and throw away all the thoughts. Now Sri Aurobindo's, what he got was unexpected, even he didn't expect it. Because he entered into a state of complete mental silence, and then the silence pervaded, became nirvana, which Bhaskar Lele was not really aiming for that. Nor was Sri Aurobindo aiming for that. Sri Aurobindo wanted yoga so that he gets the certain powers to free his country. That's what he said, that he had heard. So why not? divine providence had willed it otherwise. So that was the reason. And then even he says that Yogi Bhaskar Lele was also surprised that, well, what has happened? So he then asked him only one question: can you surrender to the divine in your heart, Vasudeva in your heart? And Sri Aurobindo said, yes. So he said, okay. That was the parting of the two. So he continued then being guided by the Vasudeva in the heart, who later on manifested as Sri Krishna. So the second personality, which is, we may use the word human or divine, because he is the avatar of the past, who came to him and as the immanent divine in man, and he led his yoga for a very long time. So it continues almost from the time he is in Alipur jail, 1908, till 1926, when he completely fuses into Sri Aurobindo. That's how we can say. When from time to time, that's a long story, but he would receive some kind of a contact. Then of course, as far as contact is concerned, Sri Aurobindo had contact with rishis, with the gods, all that he has mentioned, but that's not really receiving guidance. So there were many persons who came into his life, his inner consciousness, and so is it with the mother. Some people even have mentioned, even recently I was watching, somebody had sent me the video. I don't watch it otherwise for my comments. So there is someone who is saying he drew a lot from Western philosophers. Sri Aurobindo has clearly said, no, that's not right. Of course, he has read a lot. So that's a different thing than deriving. And you will see some common points here and there. For example, Bergson speaks about intuition. Or Teilhard de Chardin speaks about human evolution going beyond. Now, that's a different thing altogether. There will always be certain things which are common. But it's not like deriving from that. And there are letters of Sri Aurobindo. I am not reading any of them, because that would take it to another level altogether. I mean, it will be very, very long. It's a thesis. So what is it that is base of Sri Aurobindo's yoga? So the base, of course, Sri Aurobindo's letters very clearly, the way he is spoken of to the Vedic rishis and Sri Krishna, as the Gita. These are the two foundational works. And they are not foundational works in the sense that Sri Aurobindo read them and practiced the yoga. Sri Aurobindo had his experiences which he found confirmed in these books. This is a fundamental difference. So he himself says that it is Sanatan Dharma from which we derive. So Sanatan Dharma, he made a little difference from Sanatan Dharma as not opposed to, but as we compare it, let us say, to what we call as Hinduism or Hindutva. So you must understand the basic difference. So many things have got joined in the foundation or fundamental truth of Sanatan Dharma. But mainstream Hinduism has a lot to do nowadays with, you know, rituals, external practices. Many of them don't even know the name of any rishi. They may know about Vishwamitra. Very sketchily they will know about some story. They have heard about Gayatri Mantra and that's it. So we must understand that when Sri Aurobindo used the word Sanatana Dharma, it should not be considered as synonymous with Hinduism. There are many things which have joined in Hinduism, and always there has been the Gyan Kand and the Karm Kand. So what are the common elements of Sanatana Dharma which we find in Sri Aurobindo? Very interestingly, you will find these things also in esoteric Christianity, also in Sufism. So if you want to pick it like that, you will pick it. But not in the externalities of a religion. So this we have to understand. So what some of these things, because these are questions people ask. So base is Sanatana Dharma in the sense that there is one fundamental reality which governs, which is behind this creation. Now, is this reality got something to do with creation? Does it govern the creation? Or is it completely in its own inalienable light? So we see that, well, if you take certain aspects of the Upanishads, it will appear like a witness. If you take Sankhya Darshan, so it is like a witness. It has nothing to do with this reality. But Sri Aurobindo goes more by the Gita that, well, it is a witness as well as it is the Ishvara. So there is this aspect of the divine not only as a witness, but as a controller, as an ordainer. Now, if somebody takes the esoteric Islam, he'll say, yes, that's how it is described. So one has to understand that this is how we look at it. So the deeper we go into something, we'll see certain common elements. But more we look at the surface, we will not, we'll see lot of differences. When this is how, you know, Dara, who was basically a Muslim devotee, he would develop all these issues. He say, I think I have no point in staying here. So this ashram is basically for the Hindus. And because certain things of the Hindu practices got integrated, like, you know, praying at the samadhi, offering. We don't have a very rigid framework. So Sri Aurobindo has to write letters that, no, there are certain elements which are also not there. For example, I have grown up, many people nowadays don't know, there is something called as Sandhya Vandan. This was enjoined upon every proper Hindu. So if you look at the esoteric side, it's understandable that morning and evening you have very nice atmosphere, everything is quiet and you can meditate. But this is not there enjoined in the yoga, because it's a 24/7 yoga. You can't just say remember God in the morning and in the evening. So there is no such thing which is enjoined. So just some of the elements which are common and what are the difference. So one fundamental reality is common to Sanatana Dharma and Sri Aurobindo's thought. This one must know, that Hinduism is not just about the gods. There is the gods, there is one behind the god. Ekam sad vipra bahudha vadanti. This is true including in the Christian pantheon and Islam. Except that the middle rungs of gods and goddesses is gone there. Whatever be the reason, but Sri Aurobindo accepts the reality of the gods and the goddesses. They are given Hindu names, and the reason is that whatever names may have been there in other religions is gone now. So he accepts Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh, Krishna. So that is because they are the cosmic powers. So Sri Aurobindo accepts the reality of the gods and the truth of the gods. Now in Hinduism also you will see, or Sanatana Dharma, there are streams where the gods are not accepted. They are completely ignored. Nobody destroys the temples, but they are ignored. If you take the Vishuddha Advaita Vedanta, they may give concession to the gods for prayers as Sakar Bhakti. But if you go back to the roots, ultimately, you're not supposed to have any abiding truth ultimately. So gods as the cosmic creators, cosmic managers is very much there in Sri Aurobindo's thought. And because of the background, Sri Aurobindo uses Hindu terms, so it's perfectly in sync. So that's a common element. Names are also by and large same. Then the understanding of the threefold divine is same. But threefold divine is also in esoteric Christianity. Now problem is in Christianity, one has forgotten it. So many of the, because it has become very hardened, externalities have been focused, so people have forgotten that Father, Son and the Holy Spirit referred basically to the transcendent cosmic and the individual divine, or the cosmic, the transcendent individual and the cosmic divine. Father, the origin. Son, the psychic, the individual soul, and the Holy Spirit, which is all pervading. So it refers to that, but it is forgotten because now it has become, because of the yoga finishing off after a point, it was not encouraged. There was a time when there was something called as Christian yoga, esoteric Christianity. Now there are very few people who follow it. There are still, I know, there was one in Pondicherry. What was his name? He was Father Griffith. And then there was another person whom I know. I am in contact with him. He is one of the persons in the Catholic Church in Rome. So he also understood that what Sri Aurobindo has written is something way beyond, and there are elements, and he is a follower of Sri Aurobindo, but he doesn't mention it because you can't. There are correspondences with the mother of somebody, people who were there. So if we go to the roots, we'll find. But if you go to the externalities, no, certainly not. Sri Aurobindo is not saying go to church or go to temple and do Gurudwara, certainly not. Because these things, he is not stopping anybody from doing it, because this is not a yoga of saying don't do. But at the same time, it has nothing to do with Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Because that also people say, see, mother has spoken about Ganesha, so let's go to Ganesh temple. Okay, fine, nothing wrong with it. But one must know that yoga is yoga. Yoga is a serious inner business. So there is the threefold divine in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. It is transcendent, universal or cosmic, and the individual or immanent. So this threefold divine is there primarily in the Gita as Shar, Akshar and the Purushottama. Otherwise you will find it in maximum correspondence only you'll find with the Gita. So Shar, the individual, the divine, immanent in creation, ever-changing creation. Akshar, Brahma, which is the divine, which is behind all this, the cosmic. And then beyond it, the Purushottama, the transcendent divine. So this is there in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. There is the Divine Mother, which is not in Vedanta primarily. Now again, Vedic literature mentions about Aditi. It mentions about the goddesses, Ilamahi, Saraswati. But it's not primarily focused through them. In Tantra, we see the Divine Mother very prominently. But Tantra comes later. So the truth of the Tantra is there and very prominently brought out in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. We don't see in modern day Vedantic discourse or Vedantic literature. So Divine Mother has a central role in this yoga and all her different aspects, the fourfold manifestations. Now in Vaishnava yoga, you will find the fourfold aspects of the divine, which is something very similar. But there the names are Krishna, Balaram, Pradyumna and Aniruddha. So if you compare them, you will see Maheshwari, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, Mahasaraswati. But we should not try to do that because again, it has a certain shades. So Sri Aurobindo has given that aspect which is there in, for example, if you read the tantric literature of Rishi Markandeya, who describes about the Divine Mother, which is, you know, Devi Mahatma. So you will see these elements. All the four goddesses are mentioned there. So it's not like a mainstream Hinduism that way. But many things are there which are found in Sanatana Dharma. The idea of avatar is very prominently there in Sri Aurobindo. It's not there primarily in the Vedas and the Upanishads. It is there in the Gita. The Gita brings out the doctrine of the avatar, but in few short verses in chapter 4. We all know that. Sri Aurobindo develops it to what extent? And he speaks of not only the parable of avatar. Avatar is central in Sri Aurobindo's teaching. That, and it's something so beautiful. It means divine has not led us to our own resources. He does take a human birth or an animal birth to help mankind and the earth progress. So this idea of many of these Puranic elements where the earth is going, praying to the Lord, all these things we'll find in Sri Aurobindo, of course, in its own way. Of course, his yoga includes bhakti, dhyana, karma. So it's not a yoga of bhakti alone, not a yoga of karma alone, not a yoga of meditation alone. All these are included. But they are turned towards the Divine Mother for all, you know, one depends upon the Divine Mother for the fulfillment. So these are the common elements. So if you read these things, you'll see that there is a common element. So what is the difference? So one prominent difference is the goal. Transformation is nowhere the goal in any of the yogas so far. But it is true that some degree of transformational change does happen. So for example, if you read esoteric Christian mystics, you read the diary of Saint Augustine, or you read some of the bhakti time poets, you will feel that they had clear-cut psychic realization. They don't mention it, which is fine. Or they speak of God in the heart, divine in the heart. So there is the psychic transformation to an extent, because the moment psychic comes out, it has an impact upon the rest of the being. But transformation as a goal is a very different thing. It's like it is incidental to an extent, because the goal is mukti. So one doesn't much pay attention to it. There are even Vedantists who say it doesn't matter what happens to your nature, which way it goes, as long as you realize the divine. So in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, transformation is not only a side element, it's an important element. So the psychic transformation does not just stop with some change of nature. It goes into preparing the entire nature for the reception of the divine, for the transmission of the divine, for the holding of the divine. So there are special elements which come in. So transformation is a goal which Sri Aurobindo has placed for the first time. What it means is that in traditional yoga, the soul realizes the divine. Or if you take the typical absolutist Vedanta, so it will say there is no reality of the soul also. So what realizes the divine is a different thing. But it says that you live in that now, Brahman, then soul, whatever you felt as the self, individual self, drops off. So it's like a layers or merger. So then this never had a sustaining reality. But it leaves a big question mark. Then why this all this exercise? And who really benefits by this merger? Because they ultimately say it just drops off the sense of individuality. You live in that vast consciousness. But Sri Aurobindo says there is the individual soul which has an abiding reality. This is different from traditional Vedanta, and he even says it has its origin right in the supramental. So it's not something which dissolves with the realization of the Brahman. There is an individual angle through which the divine manifests himself. Even when two people have realized, and it is so clear, see, if we look at, there have been genuine people who have realized, yogis, few, but who have realized the Brahman, we cannot doubt them. But look at how they express, how they manifest. Because there is something called as the abiding truth of the individual soul. And in each soul, it expresses itself in a certain way. That's why eko ham bahushyam, otherwise it will have no meaning. If everybody has to wake up to that reality, and that has nothing to do with our individual self. Also, the other part is that the transformation of nature is not there in traditional yogas, because nature itself is considered as a field of illusion or delusion, or call it whatever. But in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, he says, just as there is a divine personality of the Purushottama, every element of human personality, thought, feeling, will, have their origin there. So what we see in human nature is just a miniature shadow of that. And that can manifest itself. So human thought can become one with the divine mind. Now this is not there in Vedanta anywhere because that reality is not there. So there is no meaning that mind will get transformed into what? But the divine has a mind, thankfully. Though he appears mindless. Because he has a super mind. But there is a mind of the divine which has gone into creation. That mind is called Maya. But this mind of God has two sides. One is the Vidyamai, which is ancient division, and Avidya. So mind of knowledge, where the divine acts on the basis of truth, which he sees in the heart of the creature. And Avidyamai, mind of ignorance, which we all embody. So this mind of ignorance must be changed into the Vidyamai, the mind of knowledge, or the mind of light, if you like. Similarly, God has a heart. He loves. Doesn't he love? It'll sound very strange. Human beings also love. Now, if this human love can be exchanged into the love of the divine, then that's what is meant by transformation of the heart. This is not there in traditional Vedanta. In traditional Vedanta, the heart and emotions are to be turned toward the divine for merger. By reflection, some change will come because you will develop some bit of sweetness. If you taste the divine Rasagulla, it's natural. But for the human heart to completely express and manifest divine love. Now, divine love can be terrible. Kali is divine love. Mahakali. So divine love is not all about, oh, sweet, sweet, so lovely, so... Divine love can absolutely break things which are not ready for expressing. So that divine love human heart must express at some point. It's very difficult. Means no attachment. Then only it is ready for the divine love. Then of course, so it goes far beyond the love of traditional bhakti. Traditional bhakti is largely those human emotions. In this bhakti there is nothing like externalities of kirtan, bhajan, nothing. Bhajan is inward. Bhajan actually means to take joy in the Lord. That's what it means, literally, technically. So if you take joy in the Lord, it is bhakti and bhajan. But if you don't take joy in the Lord, you may be sitting and clapping, waiting for the prasadam. That's not bhajan. That's singing. There is a difference in singing and bhajan. These are small little things which are necessary to be clear about. Then fulfilling God's will in us through our will. This we see in the Gita very prominent. Nimitta matra bhava sabhisachi. In all the details of life everywhere, just to be a channel of the divine will. Now here again, to become a channel of the divine will, the flesh has to be ready. That's why we have the famous saying, the heart is willing but the flesh is not ready. So it's not enough just to perceive the divine will. Rest of the nature must be ready to respond. You should not say that I have this mental idea, I have that mental idea. So one has to enter into that vastness and freedom. As if we hold on to any mental idea as... See, even in Vedanta it is there. If we hold on to any mental idea, though in, it has been lost or diluted. Now, if you hold on to any mental idea as... so sacred and dear that you cannot get rid of it. And thus I often quote the famous story of Shankaracharya and Shiva, because even with his Advaita, he is the master of Advaita in traditional Advaita. So one day he is walking and Shiva has to teach him a lesson. So Shiva comes to him on Varanasi ghats, and Shiva is like a face of a chandal and he is carrying dogs with him. And as soon as Shankaracharya sees, he says, come out, go away from my way, don't come near me. If he touches him, then he has to take a bath again, purify himself. And then Shiva asks him a question, who are you? He is totally surprised. He's asking me a question. So he replies, then he asks him more questions. And then it is a moment of enlightenment. And it is there in the Gita that, you know, what is the state of the truly enlightened one. So he says he treats the Gav, Hastini, the cow, the elephant, the swarna, money and mitti. When you live in samalost kanchana, when you are able to see all these as together, as oneness, with the eye of oneness and equality. Shitoshna sukh dukheshu hani labho jaya jayo. When you are able to rise to that state of consciousness where all these do not affect you anymore, then you are in that. That's why it says that samam brahmam, which is a fundamental thing. So as long as we have one mental conception over against another, we are not really into yoga. But at the same time, when one lives in yoga, one sees the relative place of each thing. That's what we see in Sri Aurobindo. Everything has its place. Put it in its right place, it's fine. But you start saying everything is same. Now you have entered into another error. So Isha Upanishad reminds it. So you'll see one book which comes closest to Sri Aurobindo's thought is Isha Upanishad. And it says that you have to hold these two together. If you just abandon this world of multiplicity, go into oneness, then you enter into a greater darkness. If you abandon the one for the many, you are entering into a darkness. So what is the way out? Says Vidya, Vidyancha, Yast, Dvedo, Bhayamsa. So Isha Upanishad, if wants to read one book where you will see many elements which are foundational sutras, then it is the Isha Upanishad. Second book, the Gita. And if you want to go into certain esoteric sense, the Vedas. But none of them capture the entire thing which Sri Aurobindo says, because the idea of transformation is not there. And the transformation of instrumental nature of the physical body has only been probably somewhere conceived in some passing literature. It's not about Chiranjeevi and, as a Mukta you live on other planes. It's transformation of very physical nature. Physical, not just consciousness, but of the very body and the organs. So that has never been envisaged anywhere. So these are the differences. As to the externalities, they are not included in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Caste system is not there in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. He has explained what caste meant in the, and there he has explained beautifully that the Chaturvarna and what it meant, and its inner truth remains, but the external things has no more meaning. I don't become a Brahmin because I have Pandey surname tacked to me. We are silly. I mean, I may do all the things which are. So it was always, we have spoken about it, it was always about an inner truth. So caste system, all that touchability, untouchability is not there in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. When we come to ashram, we are all mother's children. We eat in the dining room, sitting together. We don't ask, what is your caste? There are no external marks. Not only no vermilion mark and no janeyu, no gerwa, no white. One wants to wear, one can wear. But there is none of these external things in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. So here there is a departure from the what is traditionally considered as Hinduism. Now again, somebody wants to use these things, it's up to them. You want to wear a mala, wear a mala. If it helps you to do japa, using a mala, it's up to you. But the ideal japa is what one does in the heart. And this is again, there have been yogis who have told about this. Kabir Das, for example, says, he says, man ka chhod ke, man ka kyon tu fere? Man ka is also called as the beaded rosary. So he says, instead of that, do the man ka. So many places. So external, that has always been there. So common kitchen is there. If you go to now, it's no more there probably in traditional Hindu households. But there was a time when in a Brahmin household, I have myself seen, my grandmother would not allow, even I couldn't enter. After food is finished, all cleaning, everything, then you're not allowed to enter. So this used to be. Now it's not practiced anywhere. So many things which were part of the traditional culture, they are not there, but inward things. Women are equal to men. There is no subordinate thing in mother's Sri Aurobindo's yoga. They have equal right, equal access to go to the divine in every way. In fact, mother has some very strong words to say. And she has written that, in the land of Shakti, the land where Durga has manifested, it'll be a pity that we draw the differences and distinctions. But in many Hindu households, the difference is still there. In fact, she has gone on to say, why should women cook for men? Are they slaves? Thankfully, things are changing. Men are compelled to cook. And actually, if you go back to Hindu culture also, most of the cooks were men. We have seen this in marriages. Always it was the man who was cooking. But we have developed this idea. Hinduism is all about, you know, probably we have picked up all this parda from all the Islamic invasions. Otherwise, these are not things, integral part of Hinduism. So these outer rituals, such as sandhya, upanayana sanskar, janeu, pilgrimage to holy places. Again, this is, there have been yogis who have talked about it. There is a famous story of Guru Nanak when somebody was going to pilgrimage and he asked, and he is regarded very much as part of the Sanatana Dharma. Those Sikhism, okay, fine, but it draws from there. So he said, please, I am unable to go, please take this little bundle from my side also. And wherever you go, give it a dip. So he went everywhere, the people, and then brought it. So by the time they brought it was smelling badly. Then they opened, it was a Karela, bitter gourd. It is rotten fully. He said, oh, it didn't get purified. I thought it was his way of teaching. Sri Ramakrishna has also spoken about it. People asked him that how come people take a dip in the holy Ganges? Does it wash away the sins? And he said, yes. Then how come people don't change? He says, yes, because they leave their clothes outside. When they come back, they wear the dress of sin again. Now this is again not to say that the reality of Ganga doesn't exist. Shivabindu has written to the Ganges. I have had myself very clear, concrete experiences of Ganga as a purifying stream. Even you will see in traditional Hinduism, they speak about Ganga che, Yamuna che, but they are talking of the inner rivers which are there in the Vedas. And there is a correspondence of these rivers to the external realities. But to do it as a ritual and no, if I don't take a pilgrimage, like people who say, if I don't go to Makkah, I will remain what I am. You go to Makkah, you still remain what you are. You take a dip in the Ganges. So, always in Hinduism, there have been people who have said, this is not enough. In Sri Aurobindo's yoga, it is not even necessary. You take a dip in the love of the divine, that's what is important. So these external rituals, for example, you have to take a bath before taking God's name. Again, see, Swami Vivekananda has said something similar. So when he was asked about bath, etc., he said, well, if you have time, take a bath and then sit for meditation. But if you don't have time for both, then you can omit the outer bath, sit for meditation. But being here, we don't realize how much problem it creates for people. I was traveling with a Swamiji for one of my lecture sessions, and he was so uncomfortable. So I asked him, Swamiji, something is, kuch problem hai? I mean, some medical thing? Well, no, because I have not taken a bath. So I said, yeah, it's a train. Probably it will stop somewhere, but don't be troubled. He said, no, I cannot do my rosary till I have taken my bath. So I told him that take bath in the bathroom. He said, no, I can't take bath in the bathroom also. It has to be with some flowing water somewhere. So when the train stopped, myself and Mohan Bhai were there and we were waiting for him to quickly come back. Otherwise, you have to pull the chain. Now, this is actually, one can understand, this is so silly. What is the time for taking God's name? Whenever you take God's name, that is a wonderful time. So in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, you'll see that. Wake up in the morning and remember the mother. Remember her at all times while taking a bath, without a bath. So, but in certain aspects of Hinduism, but Hinduism is modified much because of many of the saints and bhakti movement, but these things are not really necessary. One thing which is a shocker for many is about marriage. So, of course, marriage in its original sense is something very nice. But there is no more that original sense. Now it has become a contract and more of division of labor. And the mother completely said that, you know, she this old system is broken. And see, she just mentioned it passingly and it's broken. All over the world it's breaking. Because it should be based on truth. So she says that if there is love, yes, people should continue together. If love has passed away, it makes no sense. So sacredness of marriage is not there. And she speaks about it. She spoke about few things like ascetic practices, the importance given to them. And I think many people, today's generation, may not be able to connect. But I don't want to mean that I am not today's generation. But I remember growing up in a household where bath was so important. You have to get up and first thing, finish your this thing, chores and take a bath. Marriage was something very sacred. And one could see the hypocrisy all around. And yet the sacredness. So there is no such thing here as, you know, Roman Catholics, they regard marriages are made in heaven. You can't divorce. There's so much problem if people have to divorce. And once I remember a case where one lady wanted, she was going through counseling. I said, you take separation, your life is miserable. So she came and told me, sir, you please convince my husband. I said, this is a bad job. I don't want to convince him. He came with the Bible. And he showed all the things that a woman is supposed to. I said, okay, now you want to quote. Okay, you please open the section where there is spoken about the duties of a man. Then we'll talk about. So people very conveniently show these things. Then he went back embarrassed. I don't know what happened because the law doesn't allow. So, but sacredness of marriage is not there. You grow together, you have that deep bond of love, very fine. But of course, sexual relations and ashram life doesn't go together. That should be understood. That's because the life of yoga. That's because sexuality is a great pull down. But it's left to each one's sincerity, each one's growth. So while there can be love between a man and a woman, there are so many instances, stories also, Mother, beautiful, true, something, aligned together. In fact, Mother goes on to say, whenever true love manifests in the life of human beings, it's something beautiful. So Shubhendu had to write to Dilip Kumar Roy as to love, friendship, care. We value these things. We don't want them to be broken at the slightest touch. That's why we insist on the psychic change. Not because these things are a taboo. But what is, again, not a taboo, but something one has to go beyond is the sexual. And there is a process in that he has given. There are two ways. One is that people drop it suddenly, or there are others. Most people go through slowly through a sanyama and then come out of it. So again, naturally, then marriage and children has no real meaning. Children, she preferred that they are not much influenced by the parents, and we can see very well why. Because most of the parents want their unfulfilled ambitions to be fulfilled in children. It's a sad truth, but it is true. And it's much better if children can discover themselves. Of course, if we don't have a atmosphere, she never said no or yes. But she preferred that, you know, these children should grow into what they are meant to be, not what their papa and mama want them to be. And that's logical, that's understandable. Rituals of cremation. So I am speaking of what is not part of Shubhendu's yoga, but still practiced in many, all cultures. So where is the religion and the spiritual element? So there are no rituals of cremation here. What is followed in the ashram is something very beautiful. First is the whole body is covered with mud. And there is the wooden and the brick layer is there. It's practiced in this Pondicherry definitely. I don't know whole of Tamil Nadu or not. But it's very beautiful. It has to be seen to be believed. And then there is the dead body over it. Dead body is not the right word. But anyways. So then a little camphor is lit in the heart. And then the chanting is Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Aurobindo. Then people put the stick, agarbatti, those who want to put, and they do pranam. Then this is whole thing is covered with mud. No pollution, no hygiene issues. Whole face, everything will be covered with mud. So you can't really see anything of the body. Bones cracking, nothing. And then there are gaps through which the fire is lit, and you want to stay, otherwise next day you come, pick up the bones, and there is visarjan in the ocean here. But the so there is a difference. Then there is nothing like a 13th day in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. If you don't even do, it's fine. But she has spoken, yes, there is an occult truth in this. So remember the person with love in your heart and the divine element. So basically connect with the divine, remember with love in your heart. And both of them say that it takes usually 13 days, but it may take 30 days, all that is. So it's not a traditional ritual, but something which one can do from deep within. So remember the person with love in the heart and send him off. Pray for the divine protection. That is the best thing one can do. So again, it's not like a typical ritual where you do a Shraddha ceremony calling a Pandit. So there are many things which are not of the standard. Again, all these things are not there in many layers of Hinduism. So various sanskars, that Mundan sanskar, then Annaprashan sanskar, then writing sanskar, beautiful though they may be, Garbhadhan sanskar, because sanskar often becomes something external. So what is important is the inner truth. Basically, you want to do it like that, it's okay. Nobody stops you. For instance, marriage. So there is no going around the ritual fire. Here, marriages are very nice, very sweet and very beautiful. You go to Sri Aurobindo's room together. Now even that has stopped. Because people started going, God knows why, but I presume every second year with someone to exchange the rings. But long back it has stopped. But used to be like that. They went to the mother, they prayed to her, and all that was done as a ritual, formal ritual, was change of rings. And this card used to be given, which is, we have read that in one of the, on marriage, which mother has spoken about. What is important is, fire is the central aspiration. And the seven planes are, you walk step by step on all the planes, you unite. So it's not a ritual. It's a profound truth which one has to realize. So again, there is no ritual marriage, there is no ritual after a child's birth, there are none of these externalities of Hinduism. But if you go to the core of Sanatana Dharma, everything is there. But what is true and new is the transformation of nature. So moksha is the goal in traditional Hinduism, which is individual moksha. But in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, it is not enough. It is a step, and the moksha here is not merger of that, the way it is understood. After moksha, you cease from the cycle of birth and death. Moksha here means that you are inwardly free. Your psychic being is free completely from all the ignorance. It knows the divine. It lives in the divine, with the divine, which is its original truth. So moksha here is more like a jivan mukta, and not moksha as refusal to come back. Then yoga here is collective yoga. This collective yoga is not a congregation of sadhaks. It's not people who are believers in the same doctrine. It's not believers who are practicing the same thing, like sects and cults where everybody gets up in the morning and does the same rituals. At least they are prescribed. No, it's not like that at all. But it's a collective yoga which is very unique to Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Again, like Sanatana Dharma. Here, each one is free to connect with the divine in their own way. And yet the collectivity has a strength, because as people from different natures, they come together. Each one who approaches in his own way, and as his nature undergoes a change, so the corresponding type undergoes a change. It's like the magnetic resonance principle, or the 100th monkey or rat, whatever way you want to. Each one has a unique nature and approaches the divine in his own way. But each nature, as it undergoes transformation, has a ripple effect on corresponding natures. So it's not collective yoga that everybody comes together and prays together and does the same ritual, same meditation, same kriya. No. It's collective yoga in the sense that each of us is connected with the world. So it's a miniature lab. What is worked upon here has an impact on the world. So in that sense, it's a very important element of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Collective yoga is not about formation of society centers. Society centers serve a great purpose. Again, I have worked in many of them, and it's a very nice, there should be places where, which is full of Sri Aurobindo and the mother's presence and people all over the world. Many of them cannot come all the way and they want to work in some way or the other. So society centers serve a great need, but it's not collective yoga. Collective yoga is each individual who practices this yoga at some point starts taking up the burden of others as his consciousness expands. He is a type. We are all types. And we are too busy seeing the type of others, but we, each one of you, is a type. And this type is not about our labeling. Good, bad, Brahman, Kshatriya, no. By type is meant unique possibility, divine possibility, unique difficulty. It is the original plan. Ekoham bahushyam. The one wants to become many. So each of us is supposed to embody some divine possibility which is unique. And corresponding to that, there is a difficulty. So each one is given only that difficulty which is meant for that person. Don't look at others' difficulty. Others may not have that difficulty as yours. And you may look at their difficulty and say, I don't have it. He will be looking at yours and saying, I also don't have. So each one has their own unique difficulty and their own unique possibility. And each one who works upon his unique difficulty and possibility helps everyone else which corresponds to that state or that element in nature. So this is the way of collective yoga here. But this collective yoga, so one can do even if one is alone. So collective yoga doesn't mean necessarily joining the ashram. And Mother has spoken about all this. And it's not a sect or common belief or a cult. Sri Aurobindo is not a sect. Sect is formed when you have a standard practice. Everybody must do certain things. Cult is formed when you have to have a... See how she has made Auroville so different. So cult is about common beliefs and sect is about common practices. So neither of them is there. Even there are people who may not believe in God, but they may believe in perfection. Fair enough. So it's neither a sect nor a cult. Anybody who believes Sri Aurobindo and is another sect and cult doesn't know what Sri Aurobindo is speaking about and obviously has not read about Sri Aurobindo and the mother. Love for the mother is a different thing. It's the common element of yoga. But each one will love in a different way. I remember one boy playing. Imagine in one of the meditation hall in one of the center playing with the tennis ball like this. Tick, 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 tick. Somebody came, don't do this. That boy was studying in the ashram school. He gave a nice reply. He said, mother is everywhere. I'm showing it to the mother. Now, I'll come back to what used to happen. See, we must, long, long back, and who has told me all the mothers, Ashtasakhis and their children, I won't take names, huh? One of them is still alive. So, they used to play in what today we call as meditation room. Know what they used to play? Ringa-ringa roses. They've even played this with the mother. And only once mother came and told them, don't make so much of noise in the afternoon. Because Pavitra Das sleeps, he was having body cancer. He very quietly told them. Where in the meditation room, can you imagine? No sect, no cult. They would even run around in the ashram. So we must understand the context in which how, what a wide range. Because she would see what is inside. And that is the most important element. Sometimes we do outer things, but what is missing is inside. So, I'm not saying people should start running and jumping and say, look here, we have just learned that we can do anything. So, this aspect of psychic being is unique in Sri Aurobindo. Again, it is mentioned in the Svetashvatara Upanishad. It's mentioned in the Kathopanishad passingly. It is there in the Gita as para, prakriti, jiva, bhuta. But it's not developed. In Sri Aurobindo's yoga, it's very unique. Because it is the crucial point. It is only the psychic being which can become the as he says, the wire between divine, the generator, and the nature as lamp. So in this yoga, the first thing is to find the psychic being. Everything else is later on. The idea of descent is there only in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. So the kundalini is there, but not rising from below upward. By force, no, there is no force applied to awaken the kundalini centers. But kundalini centers open. But from above downwards, by the descent of the Divine Mother's force, and they bring their own characteristic results. And why? Because firstly, it is a safe process, and then it is a surrendered process. The mind opens to cosmic consciousness, the heart opens to cosmic love, then the will opens, then the lower centers are touched. Unlike traditional kundalini, where if at all awakening happens, you say 99%, nothing happens, you just get some acceleration and all that, but I'm not going into that. I met people practicing, they don't understand. They sometimes give graphic description of a serpent rising and actually seeing, so we'll not talk about that. But here the kundalini opens from above downwards. And it opens means the centers which are knotted into just a little, we are given a little mind, a little heart, a little life energy. Why? Because we want little things. So, but when one opens to the mother, then you are being prepared for things which are much more than little things. I'm talking of inwardly. So the mind opens to the universal mind. The heart opens to universal love. Speech opens to the tuned divine. Beautifully described, this whole process of above downwards is described in Savitri in book 7, canto 5. And in the poem of Sri Aurobindo, the golden light came down into my mind, the grey rooms of my mind sun touched became. The golden light came down into my brain, the grey rooms of mind sun touched became. A bright reply to wisdom's occult plane, a calm illumination and a flame. The golden light came down into my throat, and all my speech is now a tune divine. A pained song of thee, my single note, my words are drunk with the immortal's wine. The golden light came down into my heart. See the whole process. Smiting my life with thy eternity. You can't say after that, me, mine, my wife, my husband, my child. Smiting my life with thy eternity. Now has it grown a temple where only thou art. And all its passions point towards only thee. The golden light came down into my feet. My earth is now thy playfield and thy seat. So this is the kundalini from above downwards. So we'll see elements of Adas Yoga. But we should not forget that these are distinct. These are different because the goal is different. So this is about the descent. This is unique to Sri Aurobindo's yoga. There is no idea of descent in any yoga. If there is some experience sometimes, it's purely, like as I said, by the way. Like bhakti does bring a certain amount of emotional purification. But that's not the same as psychic transformation. And finally, the goal itself of transformation, which is not just some change of nature, but the entire nature, which is a miniature replica, distorted and shadowed of the divine. From there it derives. That should become fully divine in all its glory and fullness. So each of us becomes not just a shadow divinity, a distorted divinity, but a miniature divinity. Not just within in the psychic being, but in our thoughts, feelings, mind, heart, will, life, all its energisms, dynamisms, the body, till even the smallest details, as Sri Aurobindo says in Savitri, our smallest parts have room for deepest needs. Even the smallest activity, such is the detailed transformation, right up to the cell, leading to the transmutation of the body and the creation of a new body. That's the ultimate project, the last thing. So this is about the just thought, because so many videos keep coming around about Sri Aurobindo's yoga, its uniqueness, its commonalities with certain yogic system, differences, the base of Sanatana Dharma, but where it takes us from there, all this. Jai Ma.